The Yeti store has so many great gifts, we had to hire a cattle auctioneer to make the most of these next 30 seconds.
All right, folks, let's get started with the Yeti French Press. Enjoy coffee that stays hot for hours in a French Press. 34-ounce for you, 6'4 for the crews. The Yeti French Press. Hot next waterproof bags. Bags waterproof. Submersible waterproof doubles. Waterproof bags. World's mostly water, so get a waterproof Yeti bag. Do I smell something cooking? All new cast iron skillets made to be passed down like mama's recipes. Take a steak, cornbread, cobbler's pot pie, and potatoes the next level with three sizes of Yeti cast iron skillets.
Gear, gifts, and product experts. Visit the Yeti store at Nebraska Crossing today.
I'm Greg Dalton.
And I'm Arianna Brocious.
And this is Climate One.
In 1960, a daring young Englishwoman set out to sort fiction from truth. She had been warned, you'll never get near the chimpanzees, but she was determined to try. Her name, Jane Goodall. She was 26 years old and destined to make scientific history.
And make history she did. Jane Goodall immersed herself in the study of primates and emerged with discoveries that challenged and changed what we know about our closest animal relatives. She's been in the public eye ever since, first as an expert on chimps, and then for her advocacy in support of the natural world.
She's a true icon. Greg, you talked with her on the show several years ago, and we were really excited to have her back on the show recently. She's celebrating her 90th birthday this year and touring the world with a really important message.
Please vote. Choose leaders committed to protecting our natural world. Vote as though our children's lives depend on it, because honestly, they do.
Of course, the U.S. election is just around the corner, and as we've covered here in previous episodes, the stakes could not be higher for climate and everything else.
And the presidential candidates practically have polar opposite plans for energy and climate policy. The difference in emissions could be huge. So it's no exaggeration that the impact of the U.S. election will last for decades.
And beyond voting, Jane Goodall is really committed to the idea of making change happen at the local level. She urges people to do their part where they live and believes that collective action, even on a small scale, can lead to much bigger change. She's really optimistic, and she exudes a confidence that change is possible, which is really inspiring.
And she's firing up audiences everywhere, including here in San Francisco. Just last week, we met up in front of nearly 2,000 people at the Sydney Goldstein Theater. And she brought along someone she really admires, Rhett Butler, the founder and CEO of Manga Bay, an international conservation news site.
They're sort of an odd couple. She's 90 years old, looking back at a lifetime of work in support of our natural world. He's much younger, at the helm of an online publication. But they have this really lovely friendship, and they both have a ton of energy and momentum when it comes to climate solutions. So today we're going to devote the whole episode to that conversation.
And now, without further ado, here's Rhett Butler and Jane Goodall.
I always feel connected, you know, when I come up to give a talk. I sort of open my heart up so that the talks I give basically the same, but they're different depending on who I'm talking to. And that can only happen if you kind of open yourself to the feeling in the room.
Okay. And you do this all the time. You were in Miami recently, in Atlanta, speaking to thousands of people. How do you keep recharged doing that all the time?
Because I care about the future, because I care passionately about the environment and wild animals, biodiversity, because I've got grandchildren, and probably at least two of them will soon have their own children, because I care about children. But most of all, it's the future of this planet. And do we want to be the one species who comes onto the planet and destroys it?
Right. And in almost a couple of generations, we're the only species that kind of destroys our own home with this intellectual brain that we think is so clever. If we're so clever, why are we destroying our own home?
Because we've lost the connection between the clever brain and the human heart, which is love and compassion. The divide between the haves and the have-nots is getting wider and wider. Mm-hmm. And the few people who have unsustainable lifestyles are doing a tremendous amount to destroy the environment. But then on the other hand, so is poverty. Poverty isn't talked about enough. But the really poor people in the rural areas, They destroy the planet simply to survive, cutting down the trees to make money from charcoal or timber in Africa, or to make more land to grow food for their growing families. And in the urban areas, they buy the cheapest junk food because it's all they can afford. They can't afford, as we three can, to ask, where did it come from? How was it made? Did it harm the environment? Was it cruel to animals like factory farms? Is it cheap because of unfair wages? They have to buy the cheapest to survive.
You write and talk a lot about hope. You have a hope cast that I've listened to. It's very good. And I have a complicated relationship with the word hope, and you wrote a book about it. You wrote that hope is misunderstood. It is often seen as passive. So what is hope? Is it a feeling? Is it a skill? And how do you access it?
Well, to me, if we lose hope, we're doomed. Because if everybody loses hope, particularly young people, what's the point of doing anything if you don't hope that what you do will make a difference?
Drink, be merry, tomorrow we die.
Yes, tomorrow we die. Yeah. And then the wealthy who don't really care because they only care about the moment will carry on and as they are doing. But, you know, people come to me and they say, well, I'm really depressed. What can I do? I'm just one person. The world's in a mess. And I say, stop thinking that you can change the world. Think about where you are in your own community. What do you care about there? Can you try and do something about that? Maybe you care about litter. Maybe you care about people in the street, homelessness, whatever you care about. See if you can find something to do about that problem. And then you'll find you can succeed, and that'll make you feel good, and you want to do more. And then you can understand around the world there's other people just like you doing what you're doing, and then you get a feeling of, yes, we can.
We're joined today by Rhett Butler, producer and founder of Manga Bay, a news site with 900 journalists covering the intersection of nature and people. And Rhett, I'd like to hear from you. How did you meet Jane and how did you get connected?
It was kind of a funny story. So I opened my email one day and I had this message and it said, from Jane Goodall. And then it said, shh, this is the real Jane Goodall. I'm a big fan of Manga Bay. I'm coming to San Francisco. Would you like to meet up?
And at this point, I'd like to say that this man sitting here, what he has created with his growing team around the world, we know we're going through dark places in the planet today, and we need to expose those places. We also need to share the good things that are being done, the hopeful things. And that's what you do with Manga Bay. And I tell everybody, if you really want to know the truth about a particular issue, go to Manga Bay.
So you get this email, and do you think it's like some scam? What do you do?
Well, there were some references to, you know, to mutual people and things like that. So I suspected that it was true. And there was an event coming up, Wildlife Conservation Network, where Jane was speaking. So there was that reference point as well. And so, you know, when she invited me to the hotel where she was staying, I figured it was legitimate. And so, you know, took that risk.
Yeah. So, okay. Environmental journalism can be dark, and there's a real problem with the doom narrative. So what are some positive stories about climate and nature that Manga Bay has covered? Because you cover the darkness and you also cover the light.
Yeah. Well, I think it's challenging because there is so much doomerism and bad news in the world. You really have to make an effort to dig out those positive stories. And so, you know, one of the big stories is there are places where recovery has happened. So you've had places like Costa Rica where you've had, you know, large-scale conversion of forests that are now coming back from. So you went from like a 23% forest cover to 50% forest cover. There's also this movement to recognize indigenous peoples and local communities and the conservation outcomes that have been achieved on their lands. And so putting local communities at the center of conservation efforts has had these, you know, really wonderful impacts. That's kind of been a transformation, I would say, in the past decade where that's been recognized. And then, you know, we're here in Silicon Valley, the emergence of technology that gives us a clearer picture of what's happening in the world and telling us what's working and what's not working. And so that's also been a very positive development.
Right. And sometimes marine protected areas are one of the positive areas. Bill McKibben recently wrote about a very positive story about a quiet, silent solar revolution in Africa where distributed solar is being deployed. It's not showing up in government statistics, and it's reaching people who need it the most because they have unreliable energy. They can't afford it, and it's really happening. Jane, what are some positive stories? Because you travel everywhere and talk to so many people. What are some positive stories that you've seen recently?
Well, it's amazing. I mean, I do travel all over the world, just about. And everywhere, and just about every culture, there are people, more and more people, passionate about the environment. I think that's one very positive bit of news, that more and more people understand, more and more people want to do something about the climate. Well, I've got this youth program, and the youth are in this program. They're passionate about making the world better, and they care, and they act. It's all about taking action. There's about 1,500 groups in across mainland China, for example. So this understanding of what we're doing to the planet is growing. And that in itself is good news. In 1960, Gombe National Park, where I studied the chimps, was a part of the Great Equatorial Forest Belt. And by the end of the 1980s, it was a tiny island of forest. All around were bare hills. The people were cutting down the forest to survive. And that's when it hit me that we need to help these people find a way of making a living without destroying the environment. And we started this program, Tukari. And it's very holistic. It includes not just restoring fertility to overused farmland without chemicals and growing more food on that newly restored land, but scholarships to give girls a chance of secondary education because they're the mothers affecting their children. Microcredit, which I feel is tremendously important, so that poor villagers can take out a tiny loan to start their own small environmentally sustainable business. And then when they pay back, and it's over 90% that do pay back in our Tukari program, they're proud. It's mine. I did it. So thanks to Dr. Muhammad Yunus for that.
Recently passed, yeah. Yeah, right. The late, I remember, you know, when he spoke at the Commonwealth Club, he said, you know, why do banks make loans to people who have money? They're not the ones who need money. You need to make loans to people who don't have money.
Yeah. And by the way, that program is in 6 other African countries now. So it's raising people out of poverty. And no more bare hills. The trees have come back.
So the nature of resilience. Well, one of the key areas in all these things we're talking about, food, deforestation, palm oil, the world's most produced vegetable oil. It's used in lipstick, cookies, laundry detergent. It's all over the grocery store. It's everywhere. Also a huge driver of biodiversity loss and destruction of rainforests. The World Wildlife Fund publishes a scorecard of companies producing palm oil responsibly. Candy makers Hershey and Mars leading the way. Smucker Jams, Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut lagging behind. So are we making progress on palm oil?
I'd like to turn that to Rhett because you've done a lot on palm oil.
Yeah, palm oil's been something that we've covered for a long time. We've probably produced thousands of stories, and it's the picture is getting a lot better. So back in the 2000s, there's just large-scale conversion of forests, especially in Malaysia and Indonesia, for oil palm plantations. And there's been this dramatic collapse in conversion of natural forests across both those countries since about 2016. In terms of conversion for palm oil. So the story has changed radically in a very positive direction. And a lot of that is because of pressure, or I guess you could say shame. So, you know,
consumer pressure, policy, both?
So it's pressure on the big companies, which comes from a variety of places. But the largest palm oil trader in the world is a company called Wilmar. And they adopted this zero deforestation commitment in about 2012 or 2013. And the rumor is the reason that happened was the CEO's daughter came home and said, "Dad, why are you killing the orangutans?" So, very powerful message, but it's groups like, you know, it's activist groups, Greenpeace, and, you know, Global Witness who are reporting on these abuses, and they're reaching people who then can influence these key decision makers. And, you know, governments tend to lag, and so you have this pressure on the companies, but the companies don't want to be the only actors, and so, you know, you get government regulation coming in, which ends up moving more of the market. Because you might have, like, you know, 20% of the market, of the players who start to implement these zero deforestation policies, but there's still a lot of damage being done by sort of the rest of the market. And so that's where regulation comes in, because it brings everyone along.
And you talk about this child coming and saying to her father, "Why are you destroying the planet?" That's the great thing about growing this youth program, because the mothers and fathers of all these children in our programs, you know, some of their parents are politicians. And some of their parents are teachers. So these young people are influencing older generations, and they're going to grow up to be the next decision makers.
Absolutely. And it's something that makes me optimistic for the future.
Yeah, me too. My biggest reason for hope.
Usually it's a daughter, by the way, who speaks to a powerful dad. There's a famous story in Silicon Valley, John Doerr, big venture capitalist, similar thing. "Dad, you caused this. What are you doing about it?" It's often the daughters reaching their dads. Jane, a couple of years ago, you co-wrote the book with Douglas Adams, The Book of Hope, and you wrote about your four reasons for hope, one of which is the power of young people, as well as the human spirit and the resilience of nature, which we've talked about, and the amazing human intellect. But let's talk about young people. A lot of young people are scared and they're angry, and there's a real mental health crisis among U.S. youth. I don't know if that's international. So what do you say to young people who are scared and worried about what naturally they're going to live in longer than you and I will?
It's very simple. I tell them to join Roots and Shoots, our youth program, because I don't think there's a single child, and we are kindergarten through university, who doesn't join Roots and Shoots, take an active role in it, and feel hopeful about the future. Hundreds of them have told me, "I feel completely different now. I feel there is hope for the future." The reason it's called Roots and Shoots is because if you think of a big tree, you love trees, I know. You probably love trees. Many people out there. Well, think of your favorite tree. It probably began with a little seed, and when it started to grow, there'd be little roots and a little shoot. And if you picked it up, it would seem so weak and powerless, and yet there's a life force, a magic in that seed, so that those little roots to reach the water can work through rocks and eventually push them aside. And that little shoot to reach the sun can work through a brick wall and eventually knock it down. So we see the young people as the roots and the shoots, and all the problems are the rocks and the walls, and they will break through.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Jane Goodall talks about the audience she cares about most, children. That's up next.
If you'd like to hear an ad-free version of our show, consider joining us on Patreon. Thanks for your support.
What do Mattel, Banana Republic, ButcherBox, and Glossier all have in common? They power their businesses with Shopify. Shopify is the most innovative and scaled commerce platform on the planet that also happens to have the best converting checkout on the planet. And that's no industry secret. That's Shopify. Learn more at shopify.com/enterprise.
This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton.
And I'm Arianna Brocious.
And for today's show, we're bringing you my conversation with Rhett Butler of Manga Bay and the legendary Jane Goodall. Before the break, we heard her talk a bit about her work with children.
In 1991, she founded Roots and Shoots. The organization's goal is to bring together kids of all ages, preschool to high school, to teach them about environmental and conservation issues.
I think Roots and Shoots is one of the most outstanding organizations I've ever been involved with, and for one main reason, really. It's youth-driven, and it allows young people to really find their voice, to express their voice in meaningful and effective ways.
Goodall wanted Roots and Shoots to be a place where young people felt empowered to make change in their communities. So that's part of the curriculum, too.
I hope that some of you are here, who are here, who don't know about Roots and Shoots. The program means that you choose yourself. We don't tell you what to do. But as a group, you choose three projects, one to help people, one to help animals, one to help the environment. And then you discuss what can we do to improve this in our community and roll up our sleeves and take action. Or you might want to help immigrants. And you will feel great when you know that around the world there are other people, other young people doing the same sort of thing. So if you're if young people are depressed, you know, tell them, of course you're depressed. We know that things are not good. But I've lived 90 years and I've seen bad times and I've seen us get over them. And somehow this indomitable spirit within us will get us through this, along with this intellect, which we have not used wisely. But we are beginning to make a difference.
And a quick note here, it wasn't just Rhett Butler and Jane and me on stage. She brought with her a little stuffed cow, a little stuffed pig, and her beloved stuffed monkey, Mr. H, who travels with her everywhere.
Yeah, it was very sweet to see her on stage, flanked by stuffies. But they weren't just props. She used them to help illustrate a key point.
And so important, and you will agree with me, is moving to a plant-based diet. And that's why I take... This is piglet, and this is cow. And what I want to say to you, it's not just that the huge areas of land that are cleared to grow food for them. It's not just that particularly cows, you know, the food goes in here and comes out the other end. And that's methane gas, and that's another vicious greenhouse gas that's, you know, affecting climate change. But just think, each one of these animals is an individual. We talk about cows, but this is an individual cow. And this is an individual pig. And I just met a pig called Pigcasso. Not Picasso, Pigcasso. Pigcasso loves to paint. Her paintings are selling for over $5,000. Her biggest painting sold for $25,000. And she lives in Cape Town. And she watched a person who rescued her from a factory farm, who's an artist, who set up an easel and gave Picasso a brush in her mouth, and she started to paint. She loves it. As soon as she sees the bucket with paints, she comes running out, and she even dips the brush in different colors to make her marks. And the only thing she's really been taught is at the end, she'll dip her snout in red paint and make her snout mark.
So there's an initiative north of San Francisco in an agricultural region talking about changing the food system. It's called Measure J, and it intends to ban basically factory farms. And judging by the number of signs all over that county, it's no, 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 because the potential jobs loss. Ranchers are against it. It seems like the food system is so big and so powerful. Yes, okay, if I eat a plant-based diet, but the number of vegetarians is not growing in this country. It's just not. It's around 3%, as for all the, you know, climatarian and alternative proteins. So how do we change such a big food system, especially when something gets on the ballot and there's this big backlash saying it's going to take away jobs, it's going to hurt ranchers?
Compassion and empathy for animals is changing people. There's no question. And the other thing, which is positive, I mean, I've become a vegan because I've understood the horrors that go on in dairy farming. And
separating young newborns from
horrible.
Their parents.
Horrible. And the conditions that the mothers are kept in is absolutely horrible. And the same with laying chickens. It's absolutely, they're in a tiny space like this, and their egg drops through a wire bottom. And I mean, I know chickens, and we have chickens in Africa. They have personalities. They're all different, very different. We have a cockerel called Tyson because he attacks you every time you appear. But anyway, so that's one side of it. But I think probably right now, I don't know if you agree with me, Rhett, but more powerful is the devastating effect on the environment and the CO2 emissions, which come from the whole of agricultural farming, actually. And then when you realize the difference when you get to permaculture and you get to agroforestry, and everybody says you can't feed more people like that, but it actually, you can grow more food that way. And we don't need genetically modified food.
I think a lot of people don't realize that about 80% of deforestation in the Amazon, which is the world's largest rainforest, is driven by cattle ranching. So it has this huge impact, not only on the animals, but also on their habitat, climate, rainfall, all these things. So it's, you know, it's a much bigger issue.
And the other positive thing, you know, when I first became vegan, the food was revolting. I mean, it was just, you got a wilted lettuce leaf or a bit of half-cooked asparagus or something. But now, you can't tell the difference.
There's also some, Rhett, you've covered some positive news stories. You know, there's deforestation in Indonesia. There's also some positive things happening there with a sort of debt for nature swaps, where some of the money that Indonesia owes the U.S. federal government, $35 million, is going to be forgiven and used towards safeguarding reefs in eastern Indonesia over the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, so this is part of a broader trend where there are new financial instruments that are available that are going into supporting conservation and also restoration. So it's really important, and there's a growing recognition of the role that nature plays in addressing many of our planetary challenges, whether it's climate change, the availability of water, so these ecosystem services. And so because a lot of decision making in the world is based around finances or economics, in order to reach certain audiences, you need to speak that language. So while some people would be opposed to the idea of financializing nature, to engage, you know, government people or the UN or whatever, sometimes you need to put a value on things and just understand that that's sort of like the lowest level value. There's also the intrinsic value and everything else, but you need sort of this starting point, speaking a language that those types of decision makers use.
Right, powerful new tools, financial innovation. Early in his administration, President Biden committed to setting aside 30% of lands and water in the United States by 2030. This 30 by 30 initiative has its roots in E.O. Wilson, saying we put aside half. They kind of said, let's try 30. It's happening internationally. Several states, California has committed to these activities, 30% of land, 30% of water. Critics have said the U.S. plan is too inclusive of activities like ranching, logging, farming. How are you feeling about our progress toward 30 by 30?
Yeah, I mean, so the key thing about 30 by 30 is it's not 30% in national parks. It's much more inclusive. So it's about building constituency around protecting nature. So that includes ranches, it includes indigenous lands, it includes like a bunch of different interventions. So the term for it is OECMs for other effective conservation measures. So, you know, a wonky conservation term, but you're not going to get 30% of the world off limits, you know, on that time frame. So it's really about being pragmatic and looking for opportunities and sort of reaching across political spectrum to find commonalities where people can agree we need to protect nature for our children and future generations, but we can do it in ways that are not necessarily excluding people from these seascapes and landscapes.
Right, and I can't rope it off. And also leveraging private landowners, right, because we're not going to get it all done by public lands.
If we cannot find ways to protect the environment for the future, then nobody should have any children because there won't be a future. We've got to understand that. We've got to take action now. And if we all take action now, even with our own individual actions, the way we can influence people, then we can, I won't say change climate change, we can slow it down and slow down loss of biodiversity because the two are intertwined, right?
You mentioned you have a great-grandchild on the way. If you were young today, how would you approach thinking of having children? Because some young couples are saying they're not. They're choosing not to. Fertility rates are dropping.
Well, that would have to be an individual choice. But the answer is, you know, if you're thinking about having a child, get involved in programs to protect the environment for your child's future.
If you're going to do it, make a world for them. Rhett, plastics are a problem, a combination of cheap fossil fuels resulting in environmental harm. About 175 countries have been working to develop a legally binding instrument on plastic pollution, hoping to wrap up negotiations this year. Manga Bay's published a lot of stories on plastics, microplastics hurting human health, bioplastics that are supposedly compostable. How are you feeling on the progress we're making on the vast plastic problem?
I mean, I think progress is being made. There's certainly a lot more awareness. I don't think progress is fast enough. My issue with plastic has always been, like, why do we need to, you know, put a banana in a plastic bag in the last 10,000 years? I mean, it makes no sense to me. And why are we holding Coca-Cola and Pepsi, the companies that are producing all this plastic, you know, holding their feet to the fire about developing real solutions? Because again, you don't, it's a perishable product that doesn't need to last 10,000 years. And so I feel like there's not enough pressure on those companies. I mean, that's changing, but it feels like progress is very slow. And then the other side, if you're looking at sort of like the economic part of the equation, is that the fossil fuel industry is building out a lot of capacity for plastic. So the expectation is that, you know, demand is going to continue to grow for these products, even if we see a reduction in demand for oil itself. So I guess I would say that I'm glad there's more awareness. I'm glad there's more pressure, but it doesn't feel like we're moving quickly enough to actually address this problem.
Right. And that's one sort of multilateral international way of tackling plastics. You know, Rhett talked earlier about people who are powerful in companies receiving pressure from the outside or pressure from inside the family. Jane, you believe that, you know, change happens from inside, that there's in the climate conversation, there's lots of naming and shaming, right? Judging people. Oh, you ate a hamburger. Oh, you flew on an airplane. Tsk, tsk, tsk. Not so sure I've done that and learned the hard way that people in my life that doesn't work. People resent that. And so how do you, if change needs to happen from the inside, how can you ignite that internal change?
Well, you know, when I meet people who I think, I personally think I've got the wrong idea, you know, that they like climate change deniers and things like that. I have found, and I think I was always made this way, that it's no good pointing fingers and being angry and making them feel bad, and especially in front of their peers, because they're not going to listen. They're going to be angry. So instead of battling with their head and telling them why they're wrong and why what they're doing is affecting this, that, and the other, you've got to reach the heart. And the only way I know how to reach the heart is by telling stories. And in order to tell a story to a powerful CEO or government official, you've got to know a little bit about them to find the right story. And if you find the right story, you may not actually know at the time that you did reach the heart, but sometimes you learn afterwards that that person changed because of that story.
You transcend a lot of the political and tribal boundaries that we have in our culture today. And you also talk with not just deniers, because that's a really small part, less than 10%, at least, of America. But you do talk with Republicans who might have a different view, who might not deny climate change and not think it's a big deal, or the markets will solve it, or technology will solve it. So how do you reach those kinds of people? Tell about your conversations with Republicans, because so few environmentalists talk across divides these days.
Well, you know, this year there have been 48 countries with major elections. And of course, the people in power in politics have a role to play in what we do to tackle climate change and all the other dark problems we face today. So many people are fed up with politics. And they don't care particularly about any. They don't even bother to read about the candidates. They just don't care. So they don't vote. And the more and more people who don't vote, then the harder it will be to vote for those people who care the most about your future. So vote for nature. Vote. Your vote matters. I mean, this is the important thing. Every single vote matters. And you need to register and you need to vote for the person you believe will be most likely to care about nature and the future of the planet.
This is the year where more people will vote or cast a ballot in the world than ever before. Elections have happened in India, Mexico, elsewhere. Some have been the same party, state, so there's sort of continuity in policy. Sometimes there's been a change in power, power's changed hands. So what have you seen from a climate lens in the elections that have happened so far?
Oof, that's a big question. I think it really just depends on the country. It's pretty...
Mexico saw a climate scientist elected. People thought, like, maybe that's a change?
It's a change, yeah. We have to see, like, what happens there, because there are... I mean, she's not president. I mean, she's becoming president.
She's walking a line with a
we'll
state
see.
Oil
yeah,
company.
I mean, there's an incumbent who has different viewpoints, so I think we have to see how that plays out.
And Brazil.
Brazil. I mean, Brazil was last year, or well, 2 years ago, I guess, and that's been a huge change. So deforestation had been trending upwards, but then it surged with the previous president. The new president came in, and deforestation's fallen by more than 50%. So more than. So what does that mean? That's more than 2,000 square miles less deforestation in the first year and a half-ish compared to the previous. You know, the previous president. And that has real implications for climate, for biodiversity, for the entire structure of the Amazon rainforest ecosystem. So really important. And so if you want to get that systemic change, you know, you have to influence people at the top. You know, individual decision making is important, but you know, you can only move the needle so far.
And it's again individuals who are voting. So
yeah, exactly.
Everybody has a role to play in getting the right people at the top.
So, Jane, I've heard you say that when you were growing up, you were encouraged by adults in your life to set your dreams on things that you could accomplish as a girl. The U.S. may finally elect a woman president in about 6 weeks. We don't know. As an iconic woman who has done so much for women in science, what do you think about this particular moment?
Well, all I know is that when I was very young, women wouldn't have dreamed really of doing what women are doing today. We still have further to go, but in some countries it's terrible, as we know, in Afghanistan and so on. But women all around much of the world have a much stronger say in what goes on in their country, in their family. And I just was fortunate in having an amazing mother. And when I dreamed of going to Africa when I was 10, because I was in love with Tarzan, and he went and married the wrong Jane. And so everybody laughed at me except my mother. She said, if you want to do something like this, then you've got to work really hard, take advantage of every opportunity. If you don't give up, hopefully you find a way. And many women have said to me, that encouraged me to do what I've done. And so, you know, women now have as much opportunity to rise to the top as men do in some countries like the U.S.
Did you find a Tarzan when you went?
Well, I knew there wasn't a Tarzan.
Okay.
My imagined Tarzan, I could never have met anybody like that.
Rhett, a lot of manga-based coverage, focused news coverage of, you know, nature and science, covers on dealing with a lot of environmental challenges that result from the actions of wealthier countries and nations, people who are like listening to us now. What have you found that helps rich Americans, for example, understand the impact of their actions on people they don't know and places they don't go?
Well, it's really about making that connection. So as Jane was talking about storytelling, you need to do that storytelling. So if you're just throwing out statistics, like no one remembers that, you know, 10,000 square kilometers of rainforest was cleared last year in the Amazon. They remember the stories around that. So the community that fought back and chase the oil company out and then restore the land. And so it is really about creating that connection. And so thinking about the products you consume, how they link back to things in the world. So the coffee you're buying, or the Oreo cookies, like where's that palm oil coming from? And it's amazing calling like that customer support line at a big company. They get a few calls, it actually can have a big impact. It is creating that connection that is really important. The other thing that is really relevant and ties in kind of with voting is the whole idea of news avoidance. So a lot of people are just bummed out by reading the news because it's so depressing. But there are types of news that people still read, even if they are news avoiders. Positive news and solutions news. And so it's an opportunity to engage people. And then if you look at the political breakdown of news avoidance, people who are on the right avoid very different types of news than people on the left. So among news avoiders on the right, something like 70% avoid climate and environment news. So if you want to engage those audiences, you need to tell those climate stories through types of news they don't avoid. So finance, economics, health, security. And so you may need to think about reaching audiences where they're at and, conveying the importance of protecting the Amazon from an economic standpoint or from a health standpoint.
We've got more of Greg's conversation with Rhett Butler and Jane Goodall after the break. Coming up, at 90 years old, Goodall says there's one more adventure she's waiting to go on. That's up next when Climate One continues.
Last year, the people of Ecuador did something remarkable. They voted to ban oil operations in part of the Amazon rainforest. This was a bold move. The economy is struggling by some measures, and yet voters decided to leave more than $1 billion worth of oil in the ground in Yasuni National Park, which is home to some of the country's indigenous people. I talked about this with Rhett Butler and Jane Goodall as part of our live conversation in San Francisco. I asked Goodall what that vote means.
The indigenous people understand that far more important than anything else is the environment. They understand perfectly well that we humans are part of the environment. And not only are we part of it, but we depend on it. We depend on it for food, for water, for clothing, for just about everything. But what we're depending on is healthy ecosystems. And I see an ecosystem as like a beautiful tapestry, and all the different complex intertwining of plant and animal species make up this tapestry. And every time a species goes from that particular environment, you pull a thread from the tapestry until it hangs in tatters and the ecosystem will collapse. And that's happening around the world. And shouldn't we at this point say how absurd that the environment has become a political topic? I mean, it's all of our environment. It's our future. What we should be doing is not fighting over it, but by getting together from both sides, red, white, blue, yellow, whatever color the party is, and trying to use this intellect, which makes us more different from the other animals than anything else. We've lost wisdom, but we've got this intellect. Shouldn't we all be getting together and working out ways of solving how to feed the world, how to keep people in a good living condition, and protect the environment? If we all got together instead of this ridiculous partisan separation, what's going on is crazy.
You're 90, and you've talked about your final chapter and what's the great beyond. Our culture avoids talking about death, yet death is integral part of nature, part of indigenous cultures who have sorts of rituals around it. So, as you look at the next decade, and I hope we sit here when you're 100, how do you think about your next chapter?
Well, I was asked this question once in an audience much bigger than this, and this woman said something about, what was my next adventure? And so I thought, this was about 4 years ago. So I thought, what is my next adventure? And I thought for a moment and I said, dying. And it was a kind of deathly harsh, and then a few titters. And I said, well, you know, when you die, there's either nothing, it's the end, or there's something. And things have happened to me in my life that I feel there is something. And if there is, I can't think of a greater adventure than dying. So before most anybody in this audience, I'll find out. I'll try and let you know.
It's something that, yeah, I mean, I think it's life-affirming to think we're in these temporary bodies. Rhett, do you think about it?
I mean, I'm comfortable with the idea of dying. I'm not something I'm afraid of, but I think, I mean, maybe I'll take this in a more morose direction, I guess. One of the things I would say is that there are a lot of environmental defenders who are putting their lives on the line every day who are, you know, getting killed or, you know, harassed or imprisoned. And I think, you know, this is a real problem. It's environmental journalists, it's indigenous leaders, it's activists, and it's something that it doesn't seem to be getting a lot better. It's consistently high. And so I think it's something that we need to be aware of, that there are people on the front lines who are, you know, putting their lives on the line for our collective well-being.
And you haven't answered his question. What do you think about it?
Oh, about dying?
Yes, about dying.
Well, I keep my affairs in order, so if it happens, you know.
When you go on a trip.
I want to, you know, leave things clean, so yeah.
He's prepared.
I'm prepared.
He's prepared. Yeah. Made a will and had it legally signed and good.
I have all my passwords stored in a system so I can just hand stuff over. You know,
your wife
good.
Is so happy to
it's
hear
good.
This.
Yeah, it's good.
Jane, as you, you know, look back over all your decades since you were a young woman sitting in the Gombe, you know, what are some of the changes you've witnessed that you think are just like really positive? You know, because we tend to focus on the degradation, the deforestation, the things that have gone darkly and badly because of this intellect, because of our greed. What are some real shining lights as you look back over the decades of doing this work and seeing so many situations and so many people?
Well, after I'd been studying the chimpanzees for 2 years, my mentor, Louis Leakey, said I had to go and get a degree at Cambridge University, even though I hadn't been to college. He said we didn't have time for an undergraduate degree. He got me a place to do a PhD. So I was very nervous, you can imagine. And imagine, I was told I'd done everything wrong. You shouldn't have given the chimpanzees names. They're just animals. They should have numbers. And you can't talk about their personality, their mind, or their emotion. Those are characteristics unique to us. Nor must you have empathy, because to be a good scientist, you must be coldly objective. So fortunately, I had this wonderful teacher when I was a child who taught me that in this respect, those professors were totally, completely talking rubbish. And That teacher was my dog, Rusty. You can't have an animal and not know that, of course, we're not the only beings on this planet with personalities, minds, and emotions. So anyway, I got the PhD, but it was the chimpanzees who helped to break down the scientific attitude of 1960 and before, that we were separate from the rest of the animal kingdom. There was a sharp line. And I suppose it was created by religion to start with. I'm not sure, but human arrogance. So, you know, the big positive change is that in country after country, we're getting better laws, better understanding of animals, more people fighting against cruelty in one form or another. That's something very, very positive, and it's still going on today. And, you know, as you said, Rhett, awareness about the environmental problems, that's growing. And with awareness and with youth programs and with young people wanting to make a difference, and the indigenous people that you mentioned, my goodness, they are so courageous and so determined and such amazing guardians of the planet. And so listening to indigenous voices is also something that's relatively recent and is a really, really important good news for us. And, well, those are just some of them. Oh, and women. I should mention, you know, the fact that women around the world are getting, in many countries, are much better. People are listening and accepting that women are as good as men, and sometimes better. Yeah. On the other hand, I must, a story I heard from an indigenous shaman in Latin America, I can't remember which country now, but he said, Jane, we call our tribe an eagle, and this eagle has two wings. One is male and one is female, and we say we will only fly high when those wings are equal.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Jane Goodall, Rep Bettler, for joining us here at Climate One today.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And if you'd like to see a video of our event with Jane Goodall and Rep Bettler, we've got it on our website, climateone.org. Or you can find it on Climate One's YouTube channel. Talking about climate can be hard and exciting and interesting, and it's critical to address the transitions we need to make in all parts of society. Please help us get people talking more about climate by giving us a rating or a review, or consider joining us on Patreon and supporting the show that way.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club, led by Gloria Duffy and Philip Yun. Our team includes Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Ariana Brocious, Austin Cologne, Megan Basilia, Ben Testani, and Jenny Lawton. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Greg Dalton.